Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning, February 20th, 2021. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 7 to 8 right here on WLIW 88.3 FM. And you can hear us live online from anywhere at wliw.org/radio. And each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com and distributed on podcast. This morning, we have two fascinating personalities for your listening pleasure. First, we start with Gary Waters, former head basketball coach at Kent State, Rutgers University, and Cleveland State. Gary turned each of those basketball programs around, becoming the winningest coach in Cleveland State University's history, and he did it his way, with respect for ethics and teaching the athletes about character and leadership on and off the court. I love these stories. It's refreshing to talk with Coach Waters, whose focus was not only on winning, but on his players graduating and his instilling a core of values and integrity in them, both on and off the court. We discuss his recent book, 10 Principles of a Character Coach, and how tough it was to hold those principles high in this win-at-all-cost environment of college sports, the big business of college sports. So I hope you find that segment fascinating. And in the second half of the show, I visit with John Webster, the director of instruction at the John Webster Golf Academy at the Breakers in Palm Beach, Florida. The Breakers is extraordinary. For those of you who have had the privilege of being there, of seeing it, of experiencing it, it is so special with such a rich, opulent history. The Ocean Course is the oldest golf course in the state of Florida. It was a joy to play it, and John and I talk about the history of the property, the refurbishing of the Ocean Course back in 2018 by renowned golf course architect Reese Jones. We talk about his golf academy and the many personalities who have visited there and play this gem. So enjoy the show. Sports Interview with Ann Liguori is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. Dune Jewelry, that's D-U-N-E, jewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game, peakvision.com, P-E-A-K-vision.com. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori, and it is my pleasure to welcome Gary Waters to the show, former head coach in college basketball. He coached with Kent State, he coached with Rutgers, he coached with Cleveland State, and did some remarkable things with the team, both on and off the court. And his new book is out called The 10 Principles of a Character Coach. Gary Waters, welcome to Sports Interview.
Well, thanks, Ann. It's a great time in this part of the year to be on a talk show because there's a lot of things going on.
There's a lot of things going on. And just from a personal standpoint, I remember when you coached Cleveland State. I am originally from Brecksville, a suburb of Cleveland, and I went to University of South Florida in Tampa. So we have a couple geographical things in common.
Yes, you're exactly right.
So you got a really great blurb for your book from one of my favorite people in college basketball, Coach K, who said that Gary has written a must-read that transcends any professional genre. The 10 Principles of a Character Coach establishes character and morality-driven fundamental practices for all aspiring and veteran coaches to infuse into their coaching DNA. Which is a great plug from one of the great
college coaches, right, Coach?
Definitely. He's the best. And, you know, he may be considered the best of all times.
So give us a little background. I know you're originally from Michigan. How did you get into coaching? And give us a little timeline of your head coaching career.
Well, you know, I started, you know, the age is there. So I started a long time ago. I've coached for 43 years now. And when I got out of college, you know, I had to make a decision because I had got been drafted into the NBA. I went and tried and didn't make it. And I had to make a decision. What would I do? You know, a lot of people continue to search for that dream and keep going. I said, no, that's just not me. And one of the things I wanted to do was I wanted to change lives and young people's lives. So that, and I thought about what should I do? And the thing I thought about doing was coaching. And that, from that point on is when I started coaching.
And I know you quoted Dr. James Naismith in the book, who basically invented the game, and his insight and his mission about the game really is similar to what your book's all about.
Exactly. And you know what? When I first started the book, and then I started reading other, you know, researching books, I researched his. And when I researched his, I seen his definition of the reason behind coaches. And when I seen that, I made a decision in my mind. I said, is this what coaches are supposed to be doing? And I looked at this and I said, if I look at the coaches today and compare it to what he said many, many years ago, do they match up? And I had a big question mark.
Exactly. Well, I know, because he feels, as you do, that coaches should be advisors, counselors, father figures, to develop character, to develop patriotism and ethical values and that kind of thing. And you just don't see that in the game these days.
Yes. You know, now I can't say it's everyone. You know, let me mention this, Ann. One thing I'm doing right now in retirement is that I'm teaching a character development workshop for the police department, law enforcement. And the whole purpose is to get them to understand the importance of character and their values out there, because you hear all the things that's happening in society and everything else. However, when I researched everything, it's not everyone that's doing this. It's a selected few. And those selected few is making it bad for everyone. And the same thing in college basketball. There's certain people that are unethical and don't do the right things. And those few, you know, take down many.
Right. What prepares one to become a good coach, in your opinion?
Well, I'm going to say, you know, first and foremost, and that's mentioned in the book, is work ethic. Because you have to make sure that you put in the time to develop the skill that you're doing. And that's basically anything in life, when you think about it, Ann, that you got to put in time to become the best at what you're doing. So you have to work at it. So you got to go out and find out things about basketball. You got to get with special people or people that you feel are good coaches to help you move forward. And you got to learn from them. But then at the same time, you got to put yourself in the game. You got to work hard each day in the game to make yourself better so you can identify if you're doing it right or if you're doing it wrong. However, you have outside people looking at you to evaluate you to give you some insight.
You know, but for many, many years, it's been winning is everything. So did you first begin noticing a decline in principle, is what you call principle driven coaching?
Well, you know what? When I was at Rutgers, and I started meeting a lot of people and I started talking to a lot of coaches there, and I seen their behavior patterns at that time. However, in that part of the country, meaning the East, they still had a lot of respect for coaches. So coaches had a lot of power. So they can help kids or they can destroy kids, all those type of things. So, but I was seeing behavior patterns that I really didn't like, I didn't gravitate toward. So I made at that point when I was there, I said, you know what, it's time for me to understand what is the right way to do this thing and what is the wrong way to do this thing. And as a coach, you have to make that decision as well.
When you said they still had a lot of respect for coaches when you were head coach at Rutgers, which was between 2001 and 2006, It wasn't like that in the other places that you coached in at Kent State and in Cleveland State, or?
Well, no, I can't say it wasn't like that, but it wasn't as strong because they, you know, the coaches in New Jersey and in New York, they really felt that they were on top of the game. And the people thought they were on top of the game. So they literally put a lot of emphasis on those coaches and they listened to those coaches. Now, when the further you go out, you know, for instance, let's take where I'm at and in Tampa. They're not really caring about a lot of basketball. What they're concerned is football. So that's coming out in this area, he's really got to work at it for people to understand what he's trying to do for the game. So during that period of time, I seen things changing. I seen behavior patterns changing. I seen how coaches were valuing other things more than the right things. And what consequently what happens is that you teach this to the kids that you're supervising. So you got to make sure that you're bringing the right things to the people that you're connected with.
So you felt you had a lot of respect as a coach at Rutgers. Obviously, you're in the New York metropolitan market. Basketball is huge there, college hoops. At one time, the Big East was so big, right?
Oh, yes.
But do you feel that with your priority as a God-fearing man, as a Christian, was it tough to garner that respect? Because that might not be the norm in college sports.
I tell you, Ed, you're right on it. You're getting right on it. And in that environment, you know, to have the values that I had is not consistent with many people in that area. Now that's a separate issue concerning coaching. Okay. See, if you know, they felt in that area, if you could coach the game, they gave you all the respect in the world. Regardless if God was in your life or whatever was in your life. So the first thing I had to say to myself, I could not compromise my values and morals, regardless wherever I was. So I had to make that commitment first. And that's what I did out there in that area. And you know what? The funny thing about it, Ann, they respected that. They respected me. They understood. Now, I think one of the reasons why they respected it, because we were winning. When you win, then forget things.
Absolutely. Winning is everything. That just seems to be, I've covered sports for, gosh, almost four decades. And, you know, honestly, it's, there's good and bad in that statement, but I know it's tough when, if you're not winning and you're a God-fearing man, then that's a whole different issue. But I know I spend a lot of time on this subject because your first principle in your book is God over everything. And, right. You know, you actually were teaching your players that very concept. How difficult was it to get everybody to buy into that?
Well, you know, what I tried to do is give them information because I think that's the biggest key. You've got to give them information and then they have to make decisions. So I wasn't forcing anything upon them. I was just giving them information because, you know, in college and even in high school, church and state is a major issue. So you got to make sure you bring it across the right way. But you know what I found out once I started communicating with the players, that they were highly receptive, that this is what they wanted. They wanted this. And so for me to infuse that into the way I was coaching really helped them, and it helped them change their lives in many places.
Sure. I would think that many of them were probably just starving for some of that guidance, for, you know, yes, somebody to look up to, a mentor such as yourself, and the wisdom and, you know, that everything that comes with, you know, having God front and center in your life.
Right, right. And that's the whole key was that they had to make sure that you put something above yourself, because our society is telling you to put yourself at the top, go for everything. You're the best. You can do this. And even in different families, that's happening. So I wanted them to make sure there's something stronger than them or bigger than them. And they had to look at that first.
My guest is Gary Waters. The book is called 10 Principles of a Character Coach. We talked about the first chapter. Principle 2 is improve yourself and others. Principle 3, live with integrity and honesty. Principle 4, treat others the way you want to be treated. 5, love unconditionally. So you listeners are understanding where this book is taking you. And the journey must have been very fulfilling. I'm sure you've combined all your years of coaching and what you've learned and what you were able to teach others into this book. It must be a very satisfying feeling, Coach.
It truly is. It truly is. And you mentioned the last one, love unconditionally. To put that as a principle, people would say, why do you have that in there? And the primary reason I put it in there is for a coach to understand that you have to be more than just a person teaching the game to them. You got to be an example for them to show them things. And so one of the things you may get many players that don't have that family structure, don't have that person that showed love in their life. Now, if they see you doing it with my wife and my children, they'll get an understanding is this may be the best way to do things. So I want it to be an example at all times and in many cases.
And that all these principles really transcend your book, transcend sports. I mean, these are lessons that everybody on and off the court should really carry with them day in and day out. They're really life lessons. So take us back through your career. You were the head coach at Kent State from 96 to 2001. When you were at Kent State in the Akron area, where was LeBron James? What stage was LeBron James at that point? Because you weren't too far away from where he grew up, right?
Oh, yeah. And I know him well. To be exact, he was just in junior high when I was at Kent. Okay. And then I watched him in high school play too. Do you know in high school, in his senior year, 80% of his games were played at the Quicken Loan Arena, at the NBA arena. So that tells you, and they filled the house every single game.
In downtown Cleveland.
In downtown Cleveland.
Wow. Okay.
So what I'm saying is they knew what they had there from the very beginning. They knew he was going to be great. And the issue that is very difficult to put together in your mind is when someone has that much pressure and those many expectations on him to still come out and not only complete the expectations, but go further than the expectation. That tells you what you had there.
When you look back at your coaching career, what would be the most memorable experience for you personally?
Oh boy, 43 years, and that's a long time now. But when I think about it, I think about the first place I was at was Kent State. And when you think about Kent State, at the time I was coming into a situation that was not very successful. They didn't have a lot and they were trying to figure it all out. And I went into that place and I was just as excited, joyful, giddy, if you want to call it. And I remember, and it talks about it in the book, in the beginning, it talks about how I was at the Final Four and I ran into Tubby Smith and he told me not to take that job because nothing's got you. You're not going to do anything at that place. If you wait longer, you can decide where you want to go. But I was so excited about doing this that it wasn't even a question in my mind. And when people asked me, was anything different than going there, than going to Rutgers and going to Cleveland State? It was just the beginning of something. And that's really what was exciting for me, to start something at the beginning.
And brag about your accolades with each program, if you would.
Well, it all started, obviously, at Kent State. And that's how I was able to move and move and move. At Kent State, for my final 3 years, we went to the NCAA 2 of the 3 years. I was there 5 years. And then we went deep into the NIT my fourth year. So my name had gotten out there. And we were having a great deal of success. And we played a lot. I played against a lot of teams. But here's the key, what got my name out there a lot. We upset many of the major programs in the country. Be exact, the year that I took the Rutgers job, we had beaten number four in the country, Indiana. So in the NCAA tournament. So now all of a sudden, they know what you're doing. They're excited about you. Then when I got to Rutgers, that was a great time too. For 5 years, we really, really improved that program. you know, because it was down two when I took it. And then, you know, we went 3 out of 4 years, the postseason tournament. And then the 1 year was the big year, was the third year I was there. We went to the finals of the NIT and we played Michigan for the championship. And it was, I mean, I'll never forget that moment, because we were playing in Madison Square Garden, and Rutgers, you know, or New Jersey's not far from New York, literally 45 minutes. And there were trains coming from Rutgers or New Jersey to New York to Madison Square Garden. And it had to be a number of trains. Each one of them were filled with Rutgers fans. They had put paraphernalia everywhere. Things were all over the place. They were singing songs. And the only reason why I know this, because I wasn't on the train, was my wife went on the train. And she was so impressed with what was going on, the excitement. Then when I came out to that game to play Michigan in that game, and Madison Square Garden seats around 20, 22,000 people. I bet you at least 15,000 to 16,000 were Rutgers fans. Just red, just yelling. I said, man, this is unbelievable.
That's awesome. And then at Cleveland State, 2006 to what, 2017?
Right.
Well, that's a long time at Cleveland State. And you did some great things. I remember when you got Cleveland State into the NCAAs.
Yes. And then we beat someone big in there. We beat Wake Forest, who's number five in the country. And you know, there were some things there that I thought really was turned around. You know, when I got to Cleveland State, they had nothing. When I'm saying it was rock bottom in where to go. And the athletic director at the time, his name was Lee Reed, who is now the athletic director at Georgetown. He literally came to me and said, hey, you need to bring this program out of the doldrums and bring it up. And so, you know, we put everything into it and it grew. And that was the positive thing about Cleveland State, because they got a coach there now that's doing a fantastic job. And I think he's piggybacking on some of the things that occurred in the past there. And that's what you need to do to have success anywhere you go. And it was great there. You know, going to the NCAA was good. But, you know, I mean, we did a lot of firsts at Cleveland State. I give you an example. Have you ever heard of the Nike All-American Camp?
Sure.
We had it there for 2 years. And everyone in the country wondered, how could we get it there? And I thought that was unique. That was a first time thing that ever went on there. And so, you know, all three places, we were the first in many things, but we wanted to be the last as well.
I love it. And then you decided after coaching at Cleveland State that you were going to retire?
Yes, I was at there. I was going into my 12th year, and I had to make a decision, because I think I had 2 years left on my contract, and I was trying to decide if I was going to go out now, or, you know, or take this or continue on and fight it. Something had happened in college basketball that really upset me. And it's really bad today. It's even has been harder in this area than any other place. There's a transfer rule that came out, and it was out before, but basketball really hadn't looked at it. And it was the fifth year transfer rule. And so a kid could go, 4 years, and say something happens, you get injured or something, he has a fifth year. And then now you've built him up. That person even has a chance to get his master's degree or anything else. However, they were starting to use the rule the wrong way. And what they were doing was, if they felt you had a good player at the mid-major level, the top level would come down and just say, hey, come in your fifth year and play for us. And the rule was you could go to another school as long as you graduated and play immediately. And I lost five players in my 2 years, my last 2 years there. And one of the years, we had two all-league players and we were picked to win everything. And we lost them because those things occurred. So I had to make a decision. Did I want to continue in this movement, or did I want to, you know, just take what has happened and move on? And I decided to take what has happened and moved on.
What have you learned the most, Coach, from your athletes, would you say?
Well, you know, the biggest thing I've learned is that there's good and bad in everyone. However, it's your responsibility to bring out the good. So when you have a responsibility of being the leader, the director, or whatever it is of what organization you have, you got to work with those people to make sure that they bring out the best that's in them. That's what I have learned. So when I was coaching, I had to make sure this player, regardless of the circumstances from his past experience in life, I had to bring the best out of him. And then if you do that correctly, it carries on in their afterlife. And that's why I have so many players calling me back, communicating with me after the fact, because it was all about that. I put that first in their development.
Well, that's a good place to stop. We could continue forever, but I really appreciate you coming on, Coach Gary Waters, former head basketball coach at Kent State, Rutgers, Cleveland State, did some remarkable things with those teams on and off the court. As I say, the book's called 10 Principles of a Character Coach, all the best coach. And I can't wait to, I know you're working on a trilogy, right? So I can't wait for the next
yeah,
one.
Yeah, it is a trilogy. And the next book that's coming out, I hope to have it out in 2022. And it's called Coaching Millennials from a Character Perspective. So, you know, when you're dealing with millennials, you know, you got a whole different bill of teaching you have to do there. However, underneath there's a little caption that says, the Rutgers experience. So it was my time when I was at Rutgers.
That should be very interesting, Coach. Well, thanks again and look forward to having you on the show, Sports Interview, another time.
Okay. Thanks, Ann. It's been wonderful.
Sports Interview with Ann LaGore is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Rope Collection. Save the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. Dune Jewelry, that's D-U-N-E, jewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game, peakvision.com, peakvision.com. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann LaGore, and my guest is John Webster, Director of Instruction here at the John Webster Golf Academy at the Breakers in Palm Beach, Florida. John, welcome to Sports Interview.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you for having me. It's great to see you.
16 years here, John. Boy, I'm sure you have a lot of stories, but before we get to your work here at the Breakers, talk a little bit about your background.
Originally, I tried to play golf like many instructors have and really wanted to stay in the business after I found that playing golf was more expensive than it was lucrative. So made my way to Florida from little by little Buffalo down to Baltimore, went to school at Loyola University in Baltimore, Maryland, came to Florida, got a job with a good friend. Buddy Antonopoulos was moving from Old Marsh to the Medalist at that time with Greg Norman. And came down, met with him, and he helped introduce me to some good people. So I started at a little place called Loblolly Pines here in South Florida. That got me started, and then I went back to Caves Valley Golf Club in Baltimore, Maryland. I spent about 9 years there, but was doing the seasonal stint where I did summers up in Baltimore. And then I got introduced to Jim McClain, which really kick-started my teaching career, and had the lucky, fortunate, time to spend with him to where he invited me to come down to Miami and do my winters there. So I kept doing summers in Baltimore, winters in Miami, and ended up spending about 9 years between those two places. And after that, really found that falling into place as a director of instruction for Jim, I had done a lot of the things from top to bottom that golf schools do and was really looking to try to establish myself somewhere. And at that time, Todd Anderson, who was here before me, made the move up to Sea Island, Georgia. And I had family that had made their way to South Florida. And it's one of those things where timing just fits. And fortunately, I was in the right place at the right time. And I was introduced to Dave Burke here at the Breakers. And that was in 1994. And I've been here ever since.
Fascinating background. You mentioned Greg Norman. I interviewed Greg Norman at Dune Bag, which he designed in Western Ireland before they even opened Dune Bag. And you were at the Doral. When I had the opportunity to interview Sylvester Stallone, thanks to Jim McClain, who taught him, and you spent a lot of time there and seeing not only Sylvester, but a lot of different personalities that came through this area, right?
I was very fortunate to be in Miami at a good time, I think. It was when it was really booming. Jim was booming at the same time, too. He was considered the teacher of the year going back at that time as well. So golf schools were really robust. There was tons of people. Miami was jumping. So, yeah, it was a very fun time to be introduced to the golf school world and see notable celebrities from Will Smith to Sylvester Stallone. And obviously you've got your athletes who come through there all the time. But quite honestly, being around Jim and having been fortunate enough to be under someone who is so passionate about the game and so enthusiastic and so good at what he does, I was very lucky to be in that position.
And Jim McClain was so kind to connect with Sylvester Stallone for me to get him to come on the show. And basically, I had to convince Stallone to come on the show based on the fact that the Golf Channel wasn't even on the air back then. He didn't know what the Golf Channel was. And I promised him, I'm not going to talk about, you know, your ex-wives. We're going to talk about golf. It's going to be really about your career, your passion for golf, and your success story. So good memories at the Doral and at the McClain Learning Center. And so what a background, John Webster, you have. And now you're here at the Breakers Hotel, and you know you have your own golf academy here at the Breakers. And this is a special place. It really is such a rich history.
It's a very unique place. And quite honestly, when I was moving from Caves Valley and the McClain School, I was trying to think of how do you combine those worlds. You have high-end private, and then you have a hotel resort where you bring in the masses, but still at a very high level. And to bring those two worlds together, it's really what the Breakers is. The Breakers has a membership, but they are also a very exclusive hotel, obviously. But the great thing about it is it's still owned by the same family that owned it since day one. So you have the Keenan family. And with our upper management that's been here for most of them over 25 years, there is still that close-knit family feel. There's a certain culture that the Breakers has that is not really a true resort culture. It is much more of a family feel within the employees. It's also more of a private club, and it's not overrun. I mean, it's one of those spots where I think every detail has been paid attention to as far as making sure that the employees feel like they truly are family, and that spreads. I mean, that goes into, and I think it is seen by the guests and visitors who come. It's a special place.
It's just extraordinary, just the architecture. And, you know, in doing my research, I looked into the history a little bit. The Breakers Hotel was founded in 1896 by industrialist Henry M. Flagler. It was named for the proximity to the water right at the breakers where the waves crashed and sprayed. And through the years and through, two fires later, the second reconstruction, the hotel was designed by the New York City-based Schultze and Weaver, who also did the Pierre in Manhattan, the Sherry Netherlands, the Waldorf Astoria, and it reopened in 1926, modeled after the Villa Medici in Rome. And when you walk around that hotel, it is just such a special place. We were recently there during the holidays, and the way they decorate for Christmas is so special. And I'm sure every season here is just extraordinary.
It is. The detail that is paid, but it, quite honestly, the reinvestment in the hotel, I mean, as a continued cycle, as I'm sure you've met with some of our upper management before and spoken to them, but the reinvestment that the family does into the hotel, a facility like this with over 500 rooms and with multiple pools and restaurants, you can just imagine how the upkeep of the facility is just constant, and there's no, you know, pulling anything back as far as budgets go. Even in tight times, we have to keep the level of service. We have to keep the level of the facility where it needs to be to really show people day in and day out what we truly are trying to do here. And that commitment is there, and we are very lucky.
Right. As you say, still owned by the same private family, the commitment to excellence to not only maintain it, but to make it just better and better almost every year is very impressive. And it's so obvious when you walk around the grounds. And this golf course has so much history as well, because wasn't it originally designed by Alexander H. Finley back in 1897? So it was really only a year after the original founding of the hotel.
Well, that is true. And then since that time, it was Brian Silva who came in and did a renovation going back about 20 years ago or so. And then since that time, Reese Jones has come back in. This was going back about 2 years now and did another redesign. And I think people notice when they come, it's an island. So we do have only so much space. but is an incredible use of that space. It's more finely kept than any course where I've been. The condition is just exquisite. And as you go around, we did something kind of special this time. We actually, as you mentioned, there are other things around the facility, such as like the Flagler Museum, you know, churches, other things just outside the property, where typically in most courses, you try to keep the golf course enclosed, where you feel like you're just on the course here. Reese actually went around the course and he actually took down to the Keenan's direction and from Paul Leone's direction to make it visible to see some of these other sites that are around the golf course. So now we're actually able to take in those views as well as enjoy the golf course at the same time.
Reese Jones, just brilliant, full-scale renovation in 2018. And talk a little bit about the renovation. I understand that now the grass is, it's all new salt-tolerant grass. And a certain kind of Bermuda grass, right, that deals with this climate.
So on the greens, we still have Bermuda, but the pospalum grass that we use throughout the facility, now that's what they put in. And it really is, it's used for brackish water where you don't have to worry about the salt invasion into your watering system. But we are fortunate. The Breakers actually, believe it or not, years ago invested in a reverse osmosis system, which actually takes all that brackish water and cleans it. So all the flowers, bushes, gardens around the place, we don't have to worry about that. So it wasn't as if that was even needed to maintain the facility. But being as we are oceanfront, this grass now is hardier. It's stronger year-round, whereas before we would have in a season where we had Bermuda grass and had to change to ryegrass into the wintertime. And that little transition time, we no longer have. So we had about 2 to 3 weeks really in the fall where we had to just water, 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 and people would unfortunately experience a very wet course. Now, we now added probably a month of golf to where the conditions are absolutely perfect, whereas in years past, we had to make that transition between grasses.
And this ocean course has the distinction of being the oldest course in Florida, yet, you know, the renovation is so contemporary, right? Some of the things that you've done here.
No, it truly is. And obviously the watering system, the drainage, things like that are constantly being upgraded. And in this last renovation by Reese Jones, a big part of it was actually to make the golf course, I'll call it more playable. The idea being is anybody who comes to the hotel, we want them to feel as if it's not overbearing. We want them to be able to get around the golf course in a reasonable amount of time, not feel like it takes all day. And we also want to challenge the better players. So what Reese did was he took out a lot of the native grasses in between the holes where you might spend time searching for your ball. Now you can find your ball more easily, but the challenge lies in the greens where he added a bunch of undulation, backstops to some of the greens where you can try to play a ball back off the backstop. Other little challenges where I think even your better player to your more novice player both appreciate it and get around the golf course much quicker than they did in years past, which is, as we know today, so much more important for a number of families. They don't want to feel as if they spend a whole day at a course. They want to go out and enjoy it and be able to get back to enjoying other things as well.
Right. So obviously limited in space here on the island, as you mentioned, but it's tricky, I'm sure, around the greens and you have to have a great short game. And I'm sure every hole has a twist to make it challenging.
You know, South Florida, our protection on golf courses is typically wind, a little bit of sand and water. So obviously we have those. But for a course that's just under 6,200 yards, which typically is enough course for just about anybody, on the certain holes, we probably have 3 or 4 par fours where your longer hitters can actually try to challenge the green, hit driver and go for it. So even for some of the tour players who we bring in from time to time, that's really the challenge is let's hit big clubs, try to hit it into a small area. And then as a practice course, you can basically come up with every and any shot you want to try to hit to be able to, you know, take your game to whatever level you'd like to. So, yeah, it does add just about everything or every aspect for just about every type of player.
John, so talk about the instruction here as the John Webster Golf Academy at the Breakers. Looks like the driving range is great. You wouldn't even expect to have a driving range here, but somehow they managed to tuck it in, and it's a beautiful facility, short game area, putting green. So can you describe it for us?
Sure. So we're very fortunate. For the amount of space we have a range which maxes out to about just under 300 yards. It is tree-lined in the back, so we do have to be cautious. Obviously, with the biggest hitters, we take them as far back as we can. But we do have a 2-bay learning center, indoor-outdoor video. We have a putting studio, which also accompanies those two. Within there, we can do just about anything. We have a short game area just off to the side of the driving range, so with bunker, two greens there. And then we do another private short game facility, which is between our third and fourth hole, where we have two greens, bunker, about 75 yards worth of short game facilities. So really with 15 instructors in winter, we make do with the space we have. We move people around and have plenty of space to do everything. But then in the summertime, half our staff goes north to a number of the more well-known clubs, whether it be in the Hamptons, whether it be in Nantucket, other areas, even over to Chicago. And then in the wintertime, when they come down, they're able to bring some of their clientele down. But in the summertime, we're able to take our staff probably down to about half of what it is in season, and then run a number of junior programs and member programs and things as such. But in the season, yeah, man, we are hustling and bustling. We do with tight quarters and tight space, we make it comfortable. If you go out on the range today, you'd see there's about 10 to 15 feet at least in between each hitting spot. Particular today with COVID conditions, it's not something that the Breakers was going to mess around with. Anybody who comes in, whether it be in our hitting bays, open space areas, or enclosed areas, space is an issue. And we made sure to minimize any group activity whatsoever, typically just with families. We don't ride in the golf carts currently with students. We'll let them take their own golf carts. So every precaution is still being taken to make sure everybody feels comfortable, particularly in the conditions we have today.
And how would you describe, is there any specialization here as director of instruction? Do you focus on any one aspect of the game, or is it the total package?
We're fortunate. We can do just about everything. We have a fitness professional on staff as well who works out of our clubhouse. So anytime someone has any questions physically, you know, about what they need to achieve or do, she is there so that we can have them screened. And obviously we would work with our members to work hand in hand with that person so people can achieve things physically. As far as short game, like I mentioned, we have the short game facilities, two different ones. We have the putting studio. So as far as short game, we're covered. And then for full swing, the nice thing about our facility is the golf course not being packed day in and day out, you know, pushing people out to get tee times. We can move from the driving range to the golf course very easily. And having that ability, I think, is great. Even in a one-hour lesson, there's times when we may spend a half hour on driving range or short game and then be able to go out on course and try to take your game to play, which I think half the time people will show up and say, boy, my range game is great, but I can't take it to the course. With half of the lessons, if you walked out today, I would say about half of the lessons we have today will be on golf course at some point during the day. And that is a huge advantage for us.
Right. Course management is so key. I mean, you can spend so much time on the range hitting balls, right? But you have to go out there and know how to apply every shot and know how to think out on the golf course. So when you have so many people coming down from New York, New Jersey, I see license plates from New York, New Jersey everywhere down here in Palm Beach. People from all over, obviously from the north, coming down to enjoy the nice weather. They're not playing in the winter. So what do you find is the first thing that they kind of lose that they have to work on when they're coming to take a lesson here?
It's so different for everybody. I mean, it really is. I'd love to say that there's just one clientele, but particularly for those coming down from up north, we typically see them trying to get prepped for the springtime or for the summertime. But because of our relationship with the instructors up north, typically we'll be able to find out what they're doing even in the wintertime. I know from Sleepy Hollow, my good friend Kevin Sprecher's up there, so he has an indoor facility. So we'll keep in touch. He'll share clients who will come down and will know what they're working on, and they'll go back and be able to work indoors there. But in today's environment, with the indoor facilities, I hate to say it, but people don't get as cold as they used to. There's always something, whether these clubs in the Northeast have an indoor facility or whether it's something like a drive shack or a Top Golf type thing. I think people used to get a lot rustier than they do today. I think it's a lot easier. And even with staying in touch with people online, I mean, we will FaceTime with students. We will go on virtually with students and be able to keep up with them. And it's not that crazy to have someone actually get online with us and be like, okay, we're going to work on putting from my office today. We are doing more of that now today than ever before. And I think there is a new way of teaching nowadays where this virtual style of staying in touch with someone is much easier, obviously, than it ever was before in the past.
That's absolutely true. It's a new world here, the virtual world of instruction, I'm sure. You're in the hotbed here, Palm Beach, Jupiter. A lot of top pros live here. Do any of them come over to say hello and to check it out, just the rich history of coming to the Breakers?
Well, probably the best story. And a number of our guys do work with a number of tour professionals, and this is the hotbed for, we'll call it, mini tour professionals as well. We're fortunate. We do a lot of school programs with three or four of the private schools here nearby, and then a couple of the public schools, as well as two of our instructors are actually high school coaches. So when you see the kids from, let's call it, early age of 5 and 6, and they come through our camps, slowly they lead into the high schools. They're playing there. So from Oxbridge Academy to Palm Beach Day to Rosarian Academy, leading into these Benjamin High School, and then seeing those kids transfer into college. Now at this point, having been here for almost 20 years, you know, we've had kids come through the ranks who have gone from, you know, we'll call it junior golf with U.S. Kids Golf, gone into AJGA golf, now have gone through high school and now are playing for universities. One fun story is Bruce Koepka worked in our bag room. So he went to Cardinal Newman with one of our other instructors, Dan McClellan. They played high school golf together, and Brooks throughout college and during some of his junior years was actually servicing our golf carts here. So yeah, it's a it's a very golfy world we're living in down here in South Florida, to where, you know, obviously with Dustin Johnson, Rory McIlroy, and all these other guys who are, you know, around the neighborhood day in and day out. This is a hotbed for golf. This is the place to be. So yes, we do see a little bit of everything from the beginners to the tour pros. And, you know, Brooks at this point is, you know, a phenomenon. Very rarely would you think you have someone working in your kart barn who just a few years later would be a multi-major champion.
That's a great story, John. Brooks Koepka worked here in the cart room and the bag area. Unbelievable. And I was so glad to see him, you know, win again at the Phoenix Open recently after enduring the knee injuries. So it's, yeah, I root for him. I just love his mental game. I think he is so strong mentally. He doesn't let all the other stuff bother him. He wears his heart on his sleeve, right? He's emotional. Just, he says what's on his mind. And boy, when he goes out on the golf course, I love watching him play.
No, Brooks is strong. And if you look back at the whole Tiger phenomenon with fitness and whatnot, Brooks is the epitome of it. And obviously what Bryson DeChambeau is doing this year, and with everybody getting bigger and stronger, you would say that Brooks is certainly the poster child for that. He is a beast and doesn't really care what everybody else does. He's in his own world, and you know, he has that mentality of a champion where nothing's going to stop him.
What are some of the other players that you admire out there, whether it's for their game physically or their mental focus?
I quite honestly appreciate guys for their game, but more so today, I probably just appreciate good guys, you know, who do the right thing. But in today's world, those who give back just as much as they get, I think are just special guys, because it does take sort of that killer instinct to be a true champion, which is difficult to be giving and still be a killer at the same time. So the guys like the Ricky Fowlers, he just does the right stuff, it seems. You know, he's one of those guys who is constantly giving to juniors. You see him with juniors. You see him giving back to charities, etc. So, and he is also here in, you know, North Palm Beach. Typically, you know, the guys on tour, I remember back years ago, the Titleist guys who, you know, I've been on staff with for almost 25 years, who I have grown to be kind of part of their family. And those guys in the tour van would always say, you know, the guys who are coming and tweaking their equipment and looking for, you know, another thing, typically aren't the guys winning. You know, the guys who are always searching and looking for something, but the guys who are winning kind of stay stable and steady. So you hate to see guys jump around too much, you know, trying to find quick answers. And I think that's what Jordan's done, is he's stuck with his guys, stuck with his team. And unfortunately, being in the top 100 in the world doesn't seem that good when you've been number one. And that's kind of unfortunate, because really there's only so much room in this game to be number one. There's one spot. And after that point, if you're not number one, again, it's hard to be critical of being in the top 100, because you are still one of the very best at what you do. It's just they want to be number one. So I think that criticism sometimes can be very difficult on guys like that, you know, when they want that number one spot. But he is still phenomenal, and I'm sure there's going to be moments. But in golf, Dr. Bob Bertello, I mean, you go back to saying that golf is not a game of perfect. That is a difficult thing for a lot of people to swallow, that it is sometimes a game of failure, and that the most enjoyable parts are overcoming those moments when you do overcome that failure. So hard to be too critical. I just pull for the guys who just want it so bad, and you hope they reach what they're trying to get to.
Well said, John. Certainly, because he, you know, three major titles, you know, basically right out of the gate. I mean, the expectation that you put on yourself if you're that good, right? You really have to. And I think he's handled it so well mentally. He really, from a mental standpoint, he's done so well with trying to, at least publicly trying to manage the expectations for himself and that other people have for him. So how about some of the women? Any LPGA players here? I saw a lot of females out there as I was walking up. There's a lot of women clinics going on, it looks like.
No, there is. And I think that's a great thing. It's nice to see how many girls are actually playing the game now and actually taking advantage of opportunities going into school. So again, I'd like to say that one of our focuses is really taking kids and building them up and putting them into positions where they can go and, you know, continue to play even at a higher level and still get great education. So, yes, and that, even that a close friend, Susie Whaley, her daughter, comes here. She's gunning to try to – she went to University of North Carolina. She's trying to make her way out there. So this is a tough year for the professionals, and particularly those people who are borderline trying to get on tour. COVID kind of knocked them out for a season because it really put them out of contention to try to – chase their dreams. So a lot of those players we're working with right now, we're just trying to stay positive with too. Unfortunately, they haven't played for anything in the last year. How do you keep your morale, keep that strong mentality that you're still going to be chasing it when you haven't had the opportunity to? Yeah, there's a number of players similar to her that we're still working with that we would love to see, you know, can still make their way out on tour.
That's another great point, John, because, wow, you know, they last over a year. Really? So not only of competing, but of schoolwork and, you know, how do you make that up? Can you make that up?
No, it's very difficult. And the motivation, I think you have to kind of follow the path of the NFL player, looking at, you know, kind of what Tom Brady's done and the longevity of his career. It's hard for golfers to constantly want to be great all the time. I think nowadays you look at the major champions, kind of what Jack Nicklaus did in his day and what Tiger really geared himself towards was trying to peak at the right times. There's a lot of golfers who don't understand that. They try to be good all the time at everything, and it's very difficult to do that. You almost have to pick and choose. All right, we're gearing up for the playoffs. Now we're gearing up for the Super Bowl. There's a time and a place when we want to peak. Well, for golfers, that's for their major championships. And I would even say for the average player, if there is something that they are playing in, let it possibly a club championship or, you know, it could be a father-son or a parent-child tournament of some sort. That mentality of literally, if you have a little project in your game that you're working towards, there's a time when you might not be at your best, but you're trying to get yourself to progress towards a moment when you're actually going to be peaking. And today you see that on the tour players. Everything is managed so finely that, you know, they're going to work their body at a certain point and take it to an extreme. Then they're going to work their game at a certain point. And then they're going to take a break and rest. I mean, it's almost that that whoop bracelet mentality where it's telling you, okay, I'm strained. I need to take my time and go take a nap for a little while. There's a time and a place, but I think now in today's world of training, I think that's more well recognized than ever before.
And Tom Brady has shown us that that's the case, right? At 43 years old as the quarterback, the winning quarterback of the Tampa Bay Bucs, right?
I'm a Buffalo Bills guy originally, so I can only cheer so deep for him. But now that he was with Tampa, I can say, okay, I'm glad he got it done and he did it against the Chiefs who knocked my guys out. So I'm happy for him.
John, what's been the highlight for you here? 16 years as the director of instruction at the John Webster Golf Academy at the Breakers. I'm sure it's hard to pinpoint any one moment, but what would you say it might be?
No, it's quite easy, actually. I mean, for me, I have two families. I have a work family, and I have my family at home, and I've been very fortunate. My parents came down to this part of the country before I did, so they're here. Met my wife down here, even though she's an upstate New Yorker. My son, Jack, now, who was going to be 7 this year, he's here. So between grandparents, my family, and now having been at the Breakers for, you know, 16 years, I quite honestly have two families. And what we've done here at the Breakers to be able to blend those two together, I'm incredibly fortunate. My father was the captain of the Notre Dame golf team back in his day. So for him, you know, I'm not important anymore. Now Jack is, and now Jack occasionally comes and hits balls. So to be able to see those two have the opportunity to play, my wife to come out with us as well, and have my son out here, just being able to have two families and be able to do what I love in a place that is really second to none is, I'm incredibly fortunate.
Sounds like just a wonderful life and a great success story. Before I let you go, how's your golf game?
I try to keep it. I try to keep it up to where it needs to be. I'm still doing well enough to where my goal is now to beat my son for the next 10 years. So as his skills improve, I know I have to keep mine. So that whole fitness thing, I think at this point, that's the battle. At 50 years old, I need another 10 years of keeping myself in as best a shape as I can to make sure I can keep him at least trying his best when he plays against me to try to beat me. So I'm keeping up. I'm trying my best to keep that game where it needs to be.
Sounds like a good goal to me. He's 7 now, so what, 17? You think he'll be maybe towering over you and beating you on the golf course?
I think it's going to be that way. It may happen sooner.
Thanks so much. A pleasure to get to know you. John Webster, Director of Instruction here at the John Webster Golf Academy at the Breakers. Thanks so much for joining us on Sports Interview.
Thank you for having me.
My thanks to Coach Gary Waters, to John Webster of the John Webster Golf Academy at the Breakers in Palm Beach, Florida, and to Delaney Hefner in the studio. Have a wonderful weekend. Be safe, be nice, have fun, and I'll talk to you next Saturday morning right here on Sports Interview with Ann LaGorrie.